I'm Karen Hartglass. You're listening to It's All About Food. It's February 11th, 2014. And how are you feeling today? I am sitting here with a lovely white ginger peach tea. And before we get into the program, I just want to ask you, are you valuing this moment of freedom that you have, this moment where you have the choice to listen to what you want and to really do what it is that you want to do in your life? We really have a lot of choices, and how often do we acknowledge them or take them for granted? Freedom is a curious and interesting thing to think about. And this show's going to get a little chilling because we're going to talk about how some of our rights may be whittling away as we speak. So let's get right to it. I want to bring on my guest, Will Potter. He's an award-winning independent journalist based in Washington, D.C., who focuses on ecoterrorism. That's in quotes, ecoterrorism, the environmental and animal rights movements and civil liberties post-9/11. He has written for publications including the Chicago Tribune, the Dallas Morning News, and Legal Affairs, and has testified before the U.S. Congress about his reporting. Potter has also worked at the American Civil Liberties Union on policy issues, including the Patriot Act. He's the creator of GreenIsTheNewRed.com, where he blogs about the Green Scare. Welcome to It's All About Food, Will.
Hi, Karen. Thanks for having me on the show.
Thank you. You know, I don't know if we've ever met, but I'm looking at your picture, and you look like a very cool guy.
Well, I appreciate that.
Anyway, I read your book, Green is the New Red. Oh, what kind of times are we living in? Thank you for writing this book, and it's scary.
You know, it is. Yeah, with everything going on right now, and I think most people aren't really aware of the scope of what's taking place, especially against protesters and against our basic rights right now.
There's I've been doing some work with climate change, and the one analogy that always tickles me is about how frogs can be in warm water, and as you slowly heat up the water, they don't know it until it's too hot and they're dead. And I think that analogy can apply to so many things and our freedom. You know, our freedom, things can slowly be affecting it until finally it's gone.
Well, and that's certainly something that's motivated my work. I mean, I think especially after September 11th, we saw how that kind of cultural change takes place and how all of a sudden we find ourselves in a much different environment. We don't realize how we got there. You know, everything that's become so normal in that 10 years, 11 years since September 11th is now, you know, it's not even questioned anymore.
Okay, so your story basically is about a number of different individuals that you've known and that you were involved with from time to time in one way or another. And some of these individuals got in a bit of trouble with the FBI and were put in prison. And the question is, should they have gone to prison? Were they punished too severely or not enough? And what's going on? And who's looking at us and why? So this was specifically with regard to animal rights activists. And I know my listeners know on this program there's a lot of horror going on with animals today. Not only. Where do I get started? Certainly we have I think the number is now up to 70 billion land animals that are killed for food every year, and they're not treated very nicely, let alone the slaughter that they go through. And then there's animals that are exploited for testing on all kinds of different products. And to read about some of these experiments, are just you just wonder, what species do we belong to? And how can anybody do these things? But they do. And then, as you can imagine, some people are outraged about this, and the reactions can vary. And some people actually got violent about it and then were punished.
Right. I mean, for years, motivated by that, that injustice and seeing what's taking place against the environment, against animals, these movements have been growing very quickly and very boldly. And beginning in the early 1980s, when these movements took a drastic shift in public consciousness and really had widespread public support, even for more militant tactics. And in response to that, the industries that were being protested had a real problem on their hands. And, you know, as people learned about these issues and the public supported the protesters, they wanted to change that dialogue. And that's really where this eco-terrorism language comes in. And, I mean, these corporations made up that word in about 1985 to shift public opinion, to shift opinion against the protesters. And over the next several decades, they used that language to the point where it became a top FBI priority.
Now, I'm not a supporter of violence, but my understanding through reading your book is that some of these people who destroyed property, property of animal testing laboratories and fur farms, anything related to animals that are being exploited, they were not punished relative to similar activity. They were punished more severely.
Absolutely. Well, and it's important to point out also that we're talking about these even the more radical tactics. In the history of these movements, no human being has ever been injured. So, you know, these are incredibly controversial things we're talking about, and they're certainly, in some cases, have been illegal actions that have taken place, but never physical violence. And yet, when people have been prosecuted in the name of the Animal Liberation Front or Earth Liberation Front, which are underground illegal groups that have done things like that, like steal animals from laboratories, release animals from fur farms, vandalize property, break windows, set buildings on fire at the most extreme, they've been prosecuted as terrorists, which reclassifies them in the prison system, allows for a much more severe punishment, and in some ways, you know, completely redefines who they are under the law and also in the public consciousness, because this language is incredibly powerful of turning public opinion against people who are facing many years in prison.
Can we talk about this term terrorism? Because you spent a good deal of time in the book talking about how we don't really have a well-defined explanation of what it is in order to prosecute using that term.
And that was one of the most difficult sections of the book to research and write, because I came to realize that there isn't any agreed upon definition of the word within the federal government, between state governments, even within international governments. The United Nations has no agreed upon definition of terrorism. And, you know, the FBI has a different definition than the CIA and Homeland Security, let alone between other countries. And really at the heart of all that is the fact that this word has its very history, the intention of being used against people to demonize them and to shift opinion and consciousness against them. So it's been used, of course, throughout world history as people that are seen as dissidents or radicals or extremists. And now we're entering in an era where it's become really divorced from what people are actually doing, whether they're actually harming any human beings or not, and instead is being applied to people because of what they believe, whether they're seen as radical in their thoughts and in their politics.
Now, we hear lots of different things about corporations and their power and the amount of money that they have and how they influence our government, and there's all kinds of policy that reflects that. So you mentioned earlier that companies were concerned about the attention that animal rights activists had been getting in the mid-80s and later, and they wanted to do something about it, and then 9/11 happens, and they had the attention of the government and more power, and they were able to craft some laws, and ultimately, because things aren't defined too well, use them so that animal rights, the few activists that were imprisoned, could actually be weakened and scare us into trying to bring out to the public what needs to be heard, which needs to be seen, so that we can make some positive changes.
That's exactly right. And for years, this was all framed under that new laws and new tactics were needed to go after these radical activists, these extremists. And for decades, that's how the argument was shaped by these industries, that people were breaking the law, that they were stealing animals, they were destroying property, raiding fur farms. Now, what's happening is that's not even the focus at all. Legislation has been introduced across the country, for instance, called ag-gag bills. And these ag-gag bills are directly targeting people who photograph and film animal welfare abuses on factory farms and slaughterhouses. And these laws have actually passed in a couple of states already, Utah, Iowa, and Missouri. And they're being considered in several others right now, for instance, in Idaho. And the language is so broad that it not only targets investigators and people who record what happens on these facilities, but also puts people like me at risk as a journalist for reporting on these abuses. And it also puts people at risk who are working in these places, see what happens, and then blow the whistle on these types of abuses. So in other words, this idea of eco-terrorism has been nothing but a ploy by these industries for years now to try to silence anyone who is exposing what actually is happening behind closed doors, whether it's more radical activists or now groups like the Humane Society.
And what it's doing is whittling away at our free speech. It's whittling away on the ability to be a whistleblower and point out things that are going on within an organization, within a company, that are bad for the environment or very cruel, and those people that might be a whistleblower or share this story without doing any violence at all can have their lives ruined.
Lawyers have, under the law, there's a phrase called the chilling effect, and it's referring to the concept that First Amendment activity might not be specifically outlawed, but when you have legislation that makes people afraid of mm-hmm. speaking up and using their rights, it has the same effect. And I would argue that's at the heart of why these attempts are unconstitutional. The message that I'm here with today is not that everyone who's listening to this program and who cares about animals or the environment is going to be labeled a terrorist or go to prison or be prosecuted. My concern is that this language is so vague and so broad, new laws like the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act are so sweeping, that it's making everyday people afraid of whether or not that's going to happen. It's making people self-censor what they think, what they speak out about, and that's dangerous to democracy. I mean, that shapes our public discourse, and it really has a disastrous effect on public debate.
All right, so that's one huge, big topic, and people need to be thinking about it. Now let's move to what happens if you happen to get caught and are sent to prison. You have a story in here about one of these activists who was actually sent to a special prison in the U.S., a communication management unit. And that sounded pretty scary, and he really, whether he deserved to be in prison for the length that he was in, he certainly didn't deserve to be sent to one of these facilities. Can you talk about what a communication management unit is?
Sure. So for Daniel McGowan, who's an environmental activist who was involved in crimes by the Earth Liberation Front, when he was being sentenced, his attorneys argued before the judge that they were so concerned about him being labeled a terrorist because it could reclassify him within the prison system and potentially result in him being housed in one of these, at the time, new prison units that were designed for domestic terrorists. And the judge says, oh, you know, that's conspiracy, that's never going to happen, this is outrageous, he has nothing to worry about. Well, it turns out that's precisely what happened. There are now two of these prison facilities in the country. They're called Communications Management Units. They exist in Terre Haute, Indiana, and Marion, Illinois. According to the government, they are for prisoners with, quote, inspirational significance. That's the language of the proposal that has been issued to make these
inspirational
facilities.
Inspirational significance?
That's right.
What does that mean?
I, of course, would argue that that's nothing but a euphemism for describing political prisoners, people who are there, who are singled out because of the, not what they did, but the politics of what they did, including Daniel McGowan, an environmentalist, Andy Stepanian, an animal rights activist. And these places, though, overwhelmingly house Muslim prisoners, over 90%. And these are not the 9/11 hijackers of the world. They're not the Zacharias Moussaouis. These are people like Dr. Raphael Dafir, who was a physician in upstate New York, who sent medical supplies to the children of Iraq in violation of the U.S. sanctions. A very political case. And these places radically restrict prisoner communications with the outside world. I was able to visit Daniel as a friend, not as a journalist, because no journalists are ever allowed there. You know, you're told you're not able to take any notes. You're not able to, certainly, to have a camera, to have any formal interview with prisoners. They only are allowed a couple of hours of visitation a month, a handful of minutes on the phone. Everything is live monitored by the counterterrorism unit. And, you know, all of this is created without any oversight. I mean, there are no checks and balances on this wing of the Bureau of Prisons. I would argue, in my opinion, it was opened illegally because there was no public comment period. And the federal government has very little to say about any of this. I mean, it's operating right now in the United States with no checks and balances and no accountability.
Wow. Okay, let's talk about the people in your book that went to prison. Are they all out now?
Almost everyone, yeah. There's still a few people that are in prison, and since that time there have been other cases that have moved forward. I mean, that's one of the difficult things of writing this book because it's part history, you know, of how we got to this point, but then the story is still continuing and evolving right now.
Okay, so what can we do?
Well, that, of course, is the hardest possible question. and I think we all feel this with all the issues that we care about right now. It's when you start to see the scope of what we're up against, it can feel very overwhelming. I mean, I do the work that I do, because as a journalist, I really have an unwavering faith in the power of education. I think nearly every issue and social justice issue that we care about and that people listening to this care about, whether you're an animal rights activist or not, really is grounded in that education. And I think that is at the root of how we begin to move forward, is by honestly looking at what's taking place. I mean, it's shocking to me the extent to which people just don't know. I do a lot of speaking events at universities in the U.S. and internationally in media, and I'm now a fellow with TED and meeting a very different group of people through that, and people just have no idea what's going on. The scope of this legislation, laws that are now on the books that people have never even heard about, even some members of Congress don't know about. And, I think that has to be the start. Where we go from there is really up to us. I mean, it's about using that education to bring a whole new group of people under the tent, so to speak, and learning about these issues, but also building new connections with other social movements, and saying, you know, we're all at risk here. This legislation, this, you know, reckless use of the language of terrorism puts all of our civil rights at risk, and that's why we need to come together under this issue.
Yeah, that's very important what you just said, because I want to improve all the lives of animals. I became a vegan a long time ago because I didn't believe in killing animals, and as I learned over the years more and more horrible stories about how terribly animals are treated, not just for food but for so many different things, and I want all of that to stop. So I support a lot of animal rights projects and activities, not violence though, personally. But there are lots of different things that we can do. But the point is that it's not just about animal rights. It's all civil rights, the ability to have our free speech and to say what we feel about a certain business or activity without worrying that we're going to be slapped in jail. And this is such a precious right here in the United States. And to see that it's being kind of covertly whittled away from us is very scary. It's like the title of your book, Green is the New Red Scare. There's so much about it that reminds me of the McCarthy era and the Red Scare. History repeating itself.
What people also need to be aware of is that what's happening in the U.S. is not only a threat to other social justice movements here and consumers here in the States, but it, in some ways, is becoming a model for what's happening in other countries. For instance, in Australia right now, this ag-gag legislation that I talked about that originated in the United States, silencing whistleblowers and investigators who expose horrific animal cruelty, is now showing up in Australia with the industry there specifically saying, we want what the United States has. We want the protections that corporations have in the U.S. When I was in Spain recently for the release of the translation of my book, I was talking to activists there, and all of the same tactics are appearing. In some cases, they're being directly modeled on what has happened in the United States against environmentalists and animal rights activists. But in some cases, it's just been more of a loose evolution as, you know, as these tactics take hold. They're naturally exported to wherever these industries need to protect their profits. And that's just, you know, I think it shows how connected we are in this struggle right now. People are really looking at what's taking place in the United States a lot more than many of us realize. I mean, activists around the world know about ag-gag laws. They know about the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act. They know about all this. And they're very concerned about it being exported to their countries as well.
Now, what's happened with the ALF and the ELF, the Animal Liberation Front and the Earth Liberation Front?
You know, in a lot of ways, after that round of prosecutions in the early 2000s, or the arrest and around that time, a lot of these actions by more illegal underground groups kind of tapered off. And it's not clear if that's a result of the prosecutions, of the FBI labeling, or if it's more of just a natural evolution of these social movements. Because as this crackdown has taken place, we really have an unprecedented level of support for environmental issues and animal protection issues. And then we see this everywhere now, veganism being discussed by Ellen DeGeneres and Bill Clinton and Oprah Winfrey. And,
yay,
you know, it's on, you know, national headlines constantly. Environmental issues, everyone says they're an environmentalist, whether or not they actually follow through with it. So, you know, I think we're just seeing a cultural change that in some ways is making activists kind of rethink a lot of these tactics and what's the most appropriate way to move forward. I mean, these movements are still alive and thriving. Civil disobedience, taking place against the Keystone XL pipeline on a national scale and investigations of factory farms. It's just the tactics are kind of evolving and changing, I think.
You mentioned that you're speaking at universities and in different venues internationally. I'm just wondering, university students are going to be interested in this sort of thing. But where is the mainstream media with in response to the book that you've written and the information that you're putting out?
Well, you know, I've been working on these issues for quite a while now, and there's certainly been a change, but it's been a slow one. Mm-hmm. You know, I think the mainstream press bears a lot of responsibility for these dangerous policies by not raising a critical voice of how that language of terrorism was exploited. But now as time goes by, and especially with the release of the book, the support from the mainstream press has been overwhelming. I mean, there was a front page article in the Washington Post about the issue, about my work, about the issues I focus on, coverage in Rolling Stone and Mother Jones and, you know, all the top media outlets in the country, the Los Angeles Times. And, you know, so I think it's beginning to change. I mean, there's certainly, it's just a drop in the bucket of, you know, just the issues that we're bombarded with every day. There hasn't been nearly enough attention on this, but I think it's changing quite a bit. It's been really inspiring to me to see how much it's changed, even the last couple of years.
Now, where are the different animal and environmental organizations on speaking out against the wrongdoings to these laws, or are they cowering?
There certainly was a lot of cowering. I mean, there's no doubt about that for a long time. You know, when the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act was being approved by Congress in 2006, it was a real struggle to find any groups that were willing to be out front speaking out about it. Now, for instance, just last year, I spoke at Georgetown Law School, and it was at a panel discussion with representation present from the American Civil Liberties Union, workers' rights groups, unions, the ASPCA, whistleblowers, a government accountability project, Compassion Over Killing. I mean, to me, this is just incredible. Mm-hmm. I mean, you more often than not, these groups are either ignoring each other or attacking each other, and frankly, in between the labor groups and environmental groups. And now they're starting to be on the same page. And to see groups like the Humane Society and ASPCA out front fighting these issues is, I think, a real positive development.
Well, on any of these issues, it's important that groups that align on something similar work together and not fight between the things that they disagree on, because we're all small and not as powerful and not as financially strong as corporations and the organizations that are trying to weaken any message that we have. We need to cooperate. That's a hard thing for people to do, cooperate.
It is, and I think, you know, I always try to remind people that whatever differences we see between each other within the animal protection movement or with other social activists, it's just infinitely small compared to the differences in priorities and interests between us and these industries, or us and, you know, some of the most powerful and wealthiest corporations on the planet that are pushing these types of tactics. I mean, there really is just it's incredible how we can get wrapped up in the smaller differences between us rather than the enormous differences that really can define our actions and how we think about these issues.
Yep, I really feel strongly about that. My favorite title in your book, and chapter title, is chapter 6, Are You Now or Have You Ever Been a Vegetarian? It's clever, it's humorous, and it's scary. Because I could see that happening.
Well, that's how, I mean, obviously joking with that, but I mean, that's how I felt when I was testifying before Congress about this law also. I was thinking back to all these hearings throughout U.S. history that have defined a lot of these eras. I just was wondering, are they going to know that I'm vegetarian? Am I going to be questioned about that? I mean, are they, mm-hmm. you know, what is the scope of how, you know, how I'm going to be interrogated about this law? And, you know, I was never asked that, of course, but the tenor of the hearing, I think, was certainly on par with what I had feared. I mean, it was Democrats and Republicans both aligning themselves with these industries and demonizing anyone who would dare speak out against them, or, you know, align themselves with animal protection groups.
Well, if they're using phrases like inspirationally significant to prove a cause or prove someone's belief that something wrong has been done, you know, anything can happen after that.
Absolutely.
Yes, very scary. Okay, it's 2014. What are the hot issues today? Are any people particularly in trouble that we should know about and try and do something about?
I think there are really two things I would want everyone listening to this to be really aware of and hopefully speak out against. One is these ag gag laws are surfacing again. I mean, last year was a huge victory. They were defeated in every single state where they were introduced, and now they are popping up all over again. It looks like the one in New Hampshire has been shut down. This bill in Idaho is moving forward. It just passed the Senate. If you're in Arizona, there's an ag gag bill that's been introduced, and I encourage people to find out about these and contact your lawmakers about how you feel, because they're really a dangerous attack on whistleblowers in an attempt to keep consumers in the dark. And the other thing I think everyone should know about is with these new environmental campaigns. Like, I think everyone's heard of the Keystone Pipeline and certainly about fracking right now. Fracking's been in the news constantly. Well, these new bills, some of them are so broad that they target anyone who's exposing what happens in those industries as well. I recently wrote about a case in Oklahoma where two young activists went into a corporate headquarters of a building, of a company that's involved in all of this, involved in fracking and the Keystone Pipeline development. And they simply unrolled this enormous banner, a hand-painted banner, in protest. And as they did that, some glitter fell off of the banner onto the floor. And then they walked out, and they even apologized. One of the activists apologized to the custodian and said, "I'm sorry, you know, we didn't mean to make a mess. We didn't know some glitter was going to fall off of this." When they got outside, they were arrested. They were later informed that they're being prosecuted for a terrorism hoax, and the police are saying, well, they didn't know if the glitter was actually glitter or if it was a chemical weapon that was being released. And I know all things like this can sound so completely absurd or even just hilarious and just like comical that stuff like this is going on. And we roll our eyes and think, oh, this is just Keystone Cops kind of stuff. But these activists are facing 10 years in prison right now. I mean, these things are real. And no matter how absurd or even kind of, I think some people hear these things and think it sounds very conspiracy theory, there's no element of that at all. I mean, this is all happening right in front of our eyes. And some people, you know, their lives are on the line.
Yeah.
I hope people will learn about this and speak out and stand behind these activists, these nonviolent protesters who are facing 10 years in prison.
Do you know where we can go to find out more about them?
Sure. If you can go to my website, greenisthenewred.com. That's just all one word, greenisthenewred.com. And there on the homepage is an article about the Oklahoma case, and I also have some information about how you can get involved in ag gag issues as well.
The ag gag issue, now right now the states are deciding whether they want to pursue something like that or have one, but ultimately we may need to go to the Supreme Court and have them shoot down all the ag gag laws. You see something like that happening?
It's really hard to say. I mean, the Supreme Court is such a lengthy fight, and also it's so up in the air of what cases are ever considered. What I can say right now is there's a legal challenge in Utah, the first challenge of its kind against any ag gag law. And I'm very proud to be part of it as a plaintiff challenging the constitutionality of this legislation. I'm involved as a journalist, like I said, because it puts my work directly at risk. Also involved are groups like PETA, the People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, and also a university professor from Texas, a former undercover investigator, and hoping to not only strike down that law but set a legal precedent of how we can begin fighting back against these others as well. So that work is being done. It's in the early stages of the lawsuit right now, but fingers are crossed.
Okay. Well, Will Potter, you're doing some good work.
Well, thanks so much for talking to me about this and helping to raise awareness. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, I just want to say that I encourage people reading Green is the New Red. Not only is it like a thriller, kind of fun to read, and I hope to see a movie about it, but I think you can appreciate how important our laws are and what good they can do and what damage they can do. And it's not just about protecting people who are innocent. It's also about protecting people who may not be innocent, but are giving them the appropriate punishment and not something really extreme.
And if there's one message to leave with everyone today who's listening to this, is that, you know, the real test of the health of a democracy and the health of our civil liberties is not whether we're out there defending all the people that we agree with, or defending all the issues we agree with, whether or not we have the courage to speak up when people that we might not be 100% in line with are being targeted and are facing this type of repression. So no matter however you feel about animal rights activists or about specific campaigns that some people have been involved in, I mean, these type of tactics are putting all of our rights at risk. And I hope that motivates people to speak up and to fight back as this legislation is being introduced.
It does take a lot of courage, and I don't want to sound negative, but it's something that people aren't likely to do unless they are personally involved or they realize how it will personally affect them. It's really hard to connect the dots and see that when one group is being affected, it can ultimately affect you and your beliefs.
You're absolutely right, and I think that it takes a lot of courage to do that. And also, I think what's helpful in doing that is realizing that this is all happening because these social movements have been so effective also. Mm. I mean, it's been inspiring to me to see how groups of people with very little money, very little resources, are threatening some of the most powerful industries on the planet on a really tremendous scale, to the point that they are trying to pass new laws to shut them down. I think that's incredible. So there's a lot to be nervous and intimidated by, you know, and I feel that every day in my work. But it's also quite inspiring. And I think if we view things in that way, hopefully that'll be the motivation people need to get off the fence and to realize what's at stake here.
This is inspirationally significant in a good way.
There you go. That's what we should all aspire to be.
Okay. Thank you, Will.
Thank you so much for talking to me.
Take care. Okay. Bye. Woo-wee. Well, I really was moved by this book, and I really do encourage you to read it, please. And then get to work however you see fit, because we all need to be participating in making this place a better world. Shall we take a break? I'm going to take a quick break and be back in a couple of minutes, and we'll talk some more. Hello, everybody. We're back. I'm Karen Hartglass. You're listening to It's All About Food. And whether you realize it or not, the last thing we were talking about, Green is the New Red, is definitely related to food. We were talking about animal rights and how activists who are trying to protect animals in different industries are affected in a negative way. And as long as we feel like we have the power and the right to abuse animals and exploit animals any way we want, it's going to affect our food. And I think animals are exploited in the greatest numbers for our food. And then that spills over into animals that are used in experiments for drugs, and understanding how the brain works, and all kinds of physical studies on how our bodily systems work. There's all kinds of experiments out there. Some of them are really outrageous, but they get approved and they get funding and people get the right to torture animals. We need to do more about that. And I believe that when we realize we don't need animals for food, when we realize we don't need to consume animals from food, when we can get all the nutrition we need, possibly even better nutrition, from whole, minimally processed plant foods, then it starts to release somehow what we have inside of us, the lies that we've been fed, the belief systems that we've been given that enable us to abuse other animals and abuse ourselves and other people. When we're eating plant foods, I think some of that gets let go. I want to believe that. And that leads us, that opens our minds to wanting to be more compassionate and protect the earth and protect other animals and protect ourselves and our families and the people around us. I really believe in the power of plants in so many ways. Now, here's something interesting. I'm going to have a Kickstarter that's going to be launching hopefully in a day or two, and I hope that you visit my website, responsibleeatingandliving.com, in the next few days and check it out. I have been invited to speak on a panel about climate change. Now, this isn't just any panel. This will be a livestock company during the weekend of a bull sale. I will literally be the lone vegan, surrounded by about 200 cattle producers. And it's going to be a very interesting event, and I'm doing a lot of research and work to prepare myself to speak to this group. Most of the time I preach to the choir, or I preach to people that want to be part of the choir, meaning that I talk to a lot of people who are either vegan or vegetarian or are very plant-friendly. And this is going to be a very different experience, and I want it to go well. Now, what's really interesting is, in addition to speaking about climate change and animal agriculture's contribution to climate change, that's really the official subject that we're all going to speak on, I've also been asked to sing the national anthem at this event. And I'm hoping that by doing that, because I've been told this group is a very patriotic group and the national anthem is a very important song to them, that through music we can all have a connection and an understanding at a profound level. I'm really looking forward to this. So again, in a couple of days, check out responsibleeatingandliving.com. I'm not exactly sure when our project is going to launch, but we need you. We need your help and support in order to make this a very worthwhile project. And then after that, I'm going to take my talk on climate change around, because few people are talking about climate change to begin with, right? And certainly you hear on Progressive Radio Network about what we do to destroy the environment and how our climate is warming up. And we're going to be seeing more and more of the impact of that on us over time. We're seeing it now with all kinds of crazy weather changes. But climate change needs to be out there more, talking about it more, because if we really acknowledge not only are humans causing this dramatic change in our environment, but we also can realize that we all as individuals can do something to slow it down. Now, what needs to happen, and it's going to happen if we have the time for it to happen, is we will slowly but surely move away from unsustainable energy, fossil fuels that are in an unlimited that are not in an unlimited supply, that are limited, but they're also very polluting in so many ways. And we need to move towards these cleaner energy sources. There's a lot of technology out there. It's a lot of really fun stuff and encouraging stuff, and people have all kinds of creative ideas. But in order to change that technology to a point where we're not putting out so much carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, we're not adding all these greenhouse gases to the atmosphere, it takes a lot of money and a lot of time. And just think, if the ideal car was created today, how many people would be able to afford to buy it so that we would stop putting carbon dioxide into the air? It's going to take a long time and a lot of money. And carbon dioxide, once it's in the air, it stays there and wreaks havoc, acts as a greenhouse gas for about 100 years. It's there for a long time. So what we need to do is a number of things, two big things in particular. This is what I believe anyway. We need to have a massive campaign where everybody is planting trees. We need to repopulate all of the forests everywhere. Well, not since the beginning, because we've cleared so much forest in order to grow food for people and have homes and businesses and all kinds of things. But we can repopulate a lot of rainforest area, a lot of area that is now being used for what? That's now being used to grow food, to feed animals, to feed people, and for cattle grazing. And the interesting thing, I mean, it all works out mathematically. We don't need as much land to grow plant foods to feed people as we do to grow plants to feed animals to feed people. It's very inefficient. So that's where you come in, eating more plant foods, eating less animal foods, or eliminating them entirely. This frees up all this land for us to plant more trees. The trees suck the carbon dioxide out of the air. They're a carbon sink. And we're all eating healthier, and our health costs go down. It's just a beautiful scenario, and it's very simple. Maybe it's pie in the sky, vegan pie in the sky, of course, but I think simplest is the best. This is a simple solution, but it takes all of us as individuals to participate. This doesn't take governments changing laws. It doesn't take major global policy changes. It does take a major global movement. You may be familiar with Wangari Maathai. She won a Nobel Prize for her work in Kenya, planting trees. And it's interesting because we were talking with Will Potter earlier about ecoterrorism and people doing things to support what they believe in, protecting animals or protecting the environment. Well, in Wangari Maathai, decades ago, proposed planting trees in her country in order to improve the land around her and improve a lot of the environment for growing food and for a lot of different things. And she was actually in prison for a while for her activism. But ultimately, they ended up planting thousands. I think it was over 30,000 trees. And she ultimately was awarded a Nobel Prize. Well, we all need to be doing this. And what does it take? So talking to all of our communities, and if you can, reaching out internationally. You know, a lot of times when people in the United States talk about what can be done in the developing world, because part of the problem with global warming, with climate change, is the developing nations are starting to pick up our habits. They're using more cars. They've got factories that are putting out more carbon dioxide. They're getting a taste for eating more meat. And this is adding to the already ridiculous amount of greenhouse gases that we're putting out into the environment. And when the United States goes and points a finger and tells other countries, you need to be doing this and that, it's kind of a hard thing to say when we're hypocrites ourselves. So we all need to be participating. And that means you. That means me. Interesting thing, when we talk about animal agriculture, specifically about cattle. Now, I'm always promoting a vegetarian, a vegan diet, not eating meat for so many different reasons. And people will respond and say, well, I eat grass-fed beef. I like humanely raised beef. And they think they're doing a good thing. Well, the science has come out and says that intensive agriculture is better for the environment than grazing cattle. and getting grass-fed beef. So from an environmental perspective, and I'm not talking about a humane perspective, but from an environmental perspective, feeding animals grains and confining them in a small area is more efficient and less polluting with respect to climate change. I'm not talking about other forms of environmental degradation, because I don't think it's as good on water and air pollution. But in terms of putting out greenhouse gases, intensive agriculture is better than grazing cattle. And here's the problem. We have our government and other organizations looking at this one little fact, this fact that intensive agriculture is better on greenhouse gases than grazing cattle. And they're not looking at anything else. We need to look at the whole picture, and we're such a reductionist culture where we like to look at one thing. It's a lot easier to test. It's a lot easier to get funding for one issue. But we're an integrated society. Our own personal bodies, when we're looking at health, our bodies are integrated. Every organ talks to the other. Everything's connected. With intensive agriculture, maybe greenhouse gases are less, but it's far less humane for the animals that are being raised. And the kind of animal that is raised in intensive agriculture is designed to be more productive. That's not good for the animal. And then there are all these other issues where we're eating more animal foods, and what's it doing to our health? We need to look at all of these issues and then decide whether one direction is better than another. But to me, the winner, hands down, is encouraging people to eat a majority of plant foods in their diet. It wins on all levels, wins. It is less polluting. It creates far less greenhouse gases and practically doesn't create any when we're talking about organic agriculture. Now, conventional industrial agriculture for plant foods has a certain amount of greenhouse gas production, and that's for manufacturing the fertilizers and the herbicides and pesticides. Well, let's do away with all of that and do really clean growing of our food. It's far more sustainable. It's much healthier for us and much kinder to us, the animals, and the planet. So you'll be hearing more about climate change, because I'm going to be studying it a lot in the next few weeks in order to do this talk in March. Just a couple of minutes left, and I always like to end on a cheery note. So about 3 years ago, I came up with a bunch of recipes that were vegan and gluten-free. Girl Scout cookies, Girl Scout copycat cookies. It's Girl Scout cookies season. And I remember I was a Girl Scout when I was a little girl, and I loved those cookies. Well, I can't eat them anymore because they're not vegan, and there's horrible ingredients in most of them. And for people that can't eat wheat, they're all full of gluten. I think they do have a gluten-free option this year because people have been screaming. But I think when it comes to treats, it's best if we make them ourselves, to put in the trouble to make them, because we really shouldn't be eating a lot of treats. And if we put the time in to make them, it just makes them so much more special. I invite you to go to responsibleeatingandliving.com. I've got my peanut butter sandwich cookie recipe up there. Delicious. Made with peanut butter that just has peanuts in it. And if you have any peanut allergies, you can use almond butter or tahini made with sesame seeds. It's a great recipe, and it's really fun. And I'm going to be revisiting some of the other Girl Scout cookie recipes that I've posted and testing them and improving them in the next couple of weeks, so you might check them out too and have a lot of fun with them. I think I've hit all the things that I wanted to mention. Just remember, are you now or have you ever been a vegetarian? Something to think about. Our freedoms, don't lose them. Don't be like the frog in the warm water, not seeing that the water's heating up, and then it's too late. too late with the environment, too late with climate change, too late with our freedoms. I say we do some good work and make this world a better place and eat Girl Scout copycat cookies. How about it? I'm Karen Hartglass. You've been listening to It's All About Food. Join me next week. I'm going to be talking to Dan Latterman and Sherry Soria of the Living Light Culinary Institute. We're going to be talking about lots of wonderful raw food recipes and how good plants are for you. Have a delicious week.